Radio City it is, episode number, oh boy, I can't count this high, 79. Oh, here we are, John Grayson, Rob Ross, once again doing our thing, and boy, what an unbelievable week it has been. And you know, it seems like we say that every week now. It's almost becoming a cliche to go, I can't believe the last 7 days actually happened.
Well, the funny thing is, and it's not funny, is that when we started to map out this week's show, it was only last Tuesday, and everything was spiraling out of control already. I mean, you think, okay, it's only Tuesday. What could happen next?
Right.
Dot, dot, dot. Well, where shall we begin, John?
Well, I tell you what, let's start on the high side, because I had a conversation this week that was wonderful. You had a conversation this week that was wonderful. So let's talk about some people we dig, because I had the opportunity to sit down, and this again is up on the KTRS.com website right now. If you want to go back and check it out, our Music Monday interview was with Wayne Kramer of the MC5. And I remember when I was a kid, probably about 9 or 10, is when I first started to really understand from listening to my dad's music that there was a lot more out there than the pop stuff that I had been listening to. And I was satisfied with AM pop radio at the time, but you know, all of a sudden I started listening to some Jimi Hendrix and some things that were a little bit more out there and things that were a little heavier. And then a buddy of mine said, oh yeah, well check this out. And he laid on me the MC5 live album. And I was just blown away. And I thought, I've got to really get into these guys. And the great thing about the MC5 to me is that even though they had certainly their proto-punk elements and they certainly had their heavy metal elements, those guys were great players. They really were. I mean, there were some guitar solos in there that were really impressive stuff. So, you know, it there was something to grab onto. So in talking with Wayne Kramer now, looking back on 50 years since the MC5 became a going concern, and they're, by the way, on tour again this year. He's also got a book out, which was the subject of the interview. My favorite piece of it is I ask him, you know, were there times when you looked around you, because they were famous for having raucous crowds that hated, you know, like all the little groups inside their crowd were all fighting with each other. You know, because it was all political. And then you had the cops who were, you know, who hated all of them. And I said, were there times when you thought, there's no way I'm going to get off this stage without taking a punch? And he said, oh, I took plenty of them. So, you know, when that was your job as a rock and roll musician, is to be in those situations where you're not going to get out of there without getting clocked a couple of times. And he said, you know, he had police point guns at him while he was on stage and say, stop playing that fucking song, that sort of thing. It's, you know, that piece of rock and roll history, thankfully, doesn't exist anymore, but it did then. And I think that it's an important thing to remember, you know, for rock bands now, few of them as there are anymore, to remember that there was a time when they didn't have, when they had to fight for the freedom to do what they do on stage, you know, when it wasn't just a given that they were going to be able to go in and play their set and leave.
Well, the thing is, that was at a time when music was vitally important. And right. I underline that very heavily.
Yep.
You know, right now, and I'm not even going to use the word rock and roll because it's almost non-existent at this stage. Yeah. You know, right now, music, pop music, whatever you want to call it, is just a marketable commodity. But back then, you know, a band like the MC5, you know, you had police at the ready to pull them off the stage, let alone probably beat them senseless with their nightsticks.
Yep.
You know, there were times when bands like the MC5, like the Stooges, more, dare I say, subversive bands, but take that in the context of the time that we're talking about, more subversive bands knew that they were kind of living to play on borrowed time.
Right.
There weren't many venues for them. It really was the perfect precursor to what later became punk rock, because obviously venues didn't want to have bands like, oh, the Sex Pistols and the Clash. And in the United States, you had bands like Black Flag or the Circle Jerks. And subsequently, clubs and the police were always at odds with one another.
Right. And on top of that, I mean, you had in their music, and it's funny to put it in these terms because we think of them as being, you know, proto-punk or metal or whatever. But you look at the lyrics and what they were writing about. I mean, they were effectively folk musicians with heavy metal music underneath them. They were chronicling the times. You listen to a song like Motor City is Burning, and all they were doing was effectively reporting.
even something like Shaken Street,
yeah,
which I still think is probably their finest hour.
Right.
You know, it's a reflection, as far as I was concerned.
Yeah.
You know, and it may be contradictory to the whole idea of the MC5 being, you know, an in-your-face kind of neo-political band, which they certainly were. It's a song of joy, really.
Right. And for a guy who ended up spending time in federal prison, you know, he's got a very sort of, not deferential, but a very realistic outlook on who he is and what the music was and what it is now, which is kind of a cool thing. You know, he gets it. Very much a pragmatist.
Yeah, and the fact that he never let the notion of legend go to his head.
Right. Yeah.
You know, he's kept it pure and simple.
Yeah, so that was fun. But you also had a conversation this week that was quite joyful in its own way.
Yeah, I spent all of Saturday afternoon with the wonderful Cindy Dawson of The Sins, who I absolutely think the world of. She's a very dear friend, and it was just fantastic to spend an afternoon just talking and finding out, you know, what she's up to, what the band is doing, what they're going to be working on in the coming months. And, you know, she's one of those people that, you know, I wasn't feeling fantastic because I've just been feeling physically ugh for the last couple of weeks, especially with this bum foot. But she has a magnificent way about her that makes you feel great. You know, she just uplifts the spirits. And she's such a wonderful conversationalist that, you know, 4.5 hours just went right by without even blinking.
Right. And that's why, even with the fact that I've never seen them live on stage, with all of the YouTube video and everything else that I've watched of The Sins, that's why she's able to make that connection with an audience, is because she is that person who can set an entire room at ease, or just a person.
The thing is, she also genuinely loves what she does. The band loves what they do. It's a true passion. There's, and again, the lack of pretension, you know, from Wayne Kramer to Cindy Dawson.
Yeah.
It's as pure as the driven snow, proverbially speaking. You know, she is such a wealth of musical knowledge. She's so into it. And the other thing is also that she has this incredible sense of giving to other bands and other performers. She and the rest of The Sins, it has to be said, are never at a lack for being willing to help other musicians out at a moment's notice. And let's face it, we live in highly competitive times, and I'm probably minimizing it, but she doesn't look at it that way. She doesn't think of it as every band for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, her attitude is, we're a community, and we need to help each other, because the avenues, frankly, are shrinking more and more every day with the closing of venues and being told what kind of music to play in particular venues. It's not too different from when I was first playing with 2 Minutes Hate, and there was that kind of thing happening in New York City, of all places, where every other storefront or building in Manhattan was in fact a club. But you were told you have to do covers, or you have to play blues, or you have to do this. And an original band was not exactly embraced. So I give her all the credit in the world for having the wherewithal to continue doing this.
Yeah.
She's very true to it. And like I said, I immensely appreciate her just as a person and as a friend. So to spend a couple of hours with her is treasured time.
That's great. And, you know, it's funny because I've said the same thing in a very different way about a good friend of mine, a guy that runs the Bar and Grill here in town. And this is a place that has become our second home. I mean, it really has, because over the 15 years that I've lived here in Waterloo, the amount of time I've spent at JV's, it's not rare to find us there 2 or 3 times a week or more. And, you know, sometimes it's just for a couple of beers and sometimes it's for dinner or whatever. But the town is changing. The town is growing, and there's more competition as far as restaurants and bars, or, you know, both. And Jeff is one of those guys who welcomes it, because, you know, it's like the Beatles and the Stones. Everybody who comes into town forces him to be a little bit better. And he's also very much into making it a community. And the philosophy of a rising tide lifts all boats. You know, the better you do, the better I'm going to do, because the better a restaurant town this is going to be. Well, it's the same thing with bands. If you don't have that attitude, you may not do it this week, but you're eventually going to slit your own throat.
I don't go out anymore, to be honest with you. There are certainly no bars that I hang out in, and you know, clubs have, well, they've run their course with me. I can't physically stand for too long a period of time either.
Right.
So that's also problematic. So the fact that you still have the ability and the, you know, the connectivity with a place after all these years, you know, I tip my hat to you, and I tip my hat to him for the fact that he's kept the place going and can have a long-standing, loyal clientele.
Yeah.
/ friends.
Right. And a lot of people, a lot of the people that were there when I first moved to town, frankly, are just gone now. You know, it's been 15 years, and the guys that were all in their 70s, they're not around anymore. So, you know, he's been able to kind of, you know, recycle an audience and bring in young people as well, which is a cool thing to do. But on the subject of restaurants, and another little bit of bullshit, by the way, that crossed the desk this week, there was...
I got one for you now that you've brought that up, but please go ahead.
There was a story about Hooters, and I don't know if you heard this, but Hooters put out a press release that turned into a news story, which is another really serious problem, but that's a way too long a story. We'll get into that on a future show. But this news story, quote unquote, broke that Hooters is going to have to rebrand because millennials don't like breasts. Now, that was the headline on the story, and what it went to was a survey that was done by Pornhub. And, you know, if you can't trust Pornhub, whom can you trust? I ask you.
Pornhub is the backbone of America at this stage.
and
I, in fact, champion Pornhub at every turn.
Right. So what they said was fewer people are putting the term boobs or breasts in the search bar. Therefore, millennials don't care about breasts, and that's why Hooters is failing. Now, aside from that being total hogwash from the beginning to the end. I mean, it makes no logical sense whatsoever. The reason why Hooters is failing is the same reason. It has nothing to do with the Hooters girls or even the food, for that matter. It's the same reason Applebee's is failing. It's the same reason Olive Garden is failing. It's the same reason that TGI Fridays and Chili's are all in trouble. They're all failing for the same reason. If there is something that millennials don't like, it's chains. They don't like them. They want to go to a place like we go to, a place where they know the guy who owns it and he lives in the neighborhood.
Here's the problem, though. And I'm going to be the counterpoint / contrarian here. They're fucking millennials.
Also true, but they do have money. Yeah.
Right. They have all this disposable income, all the arrogance in the world, and they don't know a thing.
Right.
And so whenever I hear the word millennials, I bristle. And yeah, millennials don't like breasts because they only like their own kind of weird cyber sex, because they're probably afraid of touching, you know, a member of the opposite sex or even their own sex. I don't know. But they're all such repugnant little douches.
Yeah.
They're fucking millennials. That's all I have to say. And if there's one thing that's going to get me off and running, it's millennials.
But what was the other thing that
did do to them?
Uh-huh.
I have an idea. I mean, how about we all make them actually go to work?
Oh, no. Now you know, you're going to trigger somebody with talk like that.
Oh, am I going to trigger somebody? Oh, I'm going to make somebody cry.
You didn't issue a trigger warning. I think that's some kind of 15-yard violation or something. So, but you said there was something else about restaurants.
Well, you just brought up restaurants, and here's an experience that happened yesterday. Not a joke. It was maybe 10 after 12 in the afternoon. I stopped in a Dairy Queen, okay? I wanted to get the Jurassic Chomp Blizzard, which is delivered from God himself.
Yeah, good choice.
And I wanted it with the chocolate ice cream, because if you're going to put those chocolate peanut butter balls in ice cream, it better be a chocolate ice cream, right?
Uh-huh.
I wait about 5-10 minutes online. I say I'd like a large Jurassic Chomp Blizzard. Guy looks me right in the eye and says, "We don't have any chocolate ice cream today." What the fuck?
Wow.
It's 10 after 12. You only have two flavors of ice cream.
Yeah, it's not like you're Baskin Robbins, for crying out loud.
God damn it, John. This is your proverbial, you had one job.
Right.
And this is exactly like the time about 20 years ago that I went into Taco Bell just after they opened at 12 noon, ordered two tacos, and were told we're out of taco shells.
Right. Yeah.
There's no irony in that.
How is that even? It's in your name.
Right, which tells you why there are no Taco Bells left on Staten Island.
Uh-huh.
Okay? But yeah, Dairy Queen, you have made an epic fucking fail. That's worse than 2 weeks ago when we went to Popeyes and were told that they didn't have any chicken strips.
How is
this possible?
Yeah. Now, you see, what you need to do is you need to hang out with my wife because, well, that sounded weird. But anyway, no, she is the queen of that, unfortunately. And it has become, see, I thought she was being hyperbolic when we first started really seriously dating, because we went to a restaurant and she ordered something and they said, oh, I'm sorry, we don't have that today, or we don't serve that anymore, or something like that. And she just got this look on her face that was this resigned, oh, God, not this again. And I said, what's the deal? And she said, no, you don't understand. This happens to me about one out of every three times I go anywhere. And I thought, oh, come on. Now we've been married for 10 years. She wasn't lying. I don't know how it happens, but she is able to pick out the one thing on the menu that they're either out of that day or they discontinued. It's uncanny.
There was a restaurant that got a lot of hype on Staten Island because it was brand new and it was opening up, called Hook and Reel. And it was supposed to be one of those seafood restaurants not dissimilar to Joe's Crab Shack.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, that would be helpful for us so that way we don't have to drive all the way to New Jersey to enjoy an afternoon at Joe's.
Right, a bucket of beer and whatever, sure.
Right. And so we went to this place on opening weekend. Now, it opened up Thursday night, so we went Saturday afternoon at about 1 o'clock. When I tell you, first and foremost, the place was empty. There was no excuse for the lousy service that we got, or non-service that we got. It took a year and a day for the waitress to figure out how to get us the drinks, to bring us the appetizers, which were supposed to be hush puppies, and instead, what we got were these, obviously, frozen and then warmed up little things that look like finger sausages rather than proper hush puppies.
Oh, because those are real hard to make.
Right.
Come on.
Now, Liz and I ordered the oyster po' boys.
Okay.
Okay? We waited a half hour, and then the manager comes to the table and tells us we don't have the bread to make the sandwiches. Now, usually I am very, very diplomatic, and I was. I maintained my calm, and I just stood up and I said, we're leaving and we're not paying for any of this. I said, it is the middle of the afternoon. You have this entire staff here standing around doing nothing. There's no one in this restaurant, okay? It took up to a half hour, A, for her to bring these so-called hush puppies and for you guys to figure out that you don't have the bread to make the sandwiches that we ordered a half hour ago, instead of telling us right away, this is your opening weekend, you're not going to be around long.
Yeah, right.
Right now, I am going to write the nastiest review I can find on Yelp, because you need to be exposed for being an absolute disgrace. If this is an opening weekend, I wish you the worst of luck.
Now,
because I was beyond pissed.
Are they still there?
Yeah, they're kind of fumbling along.
Okay.
I'm sure they'll be gone by year's end, you know. But most people that have reviewed them said the same thing. You know, it's just flat and uninteresting when they get something. You know, when we go to Joe's Crab Shack, and I know it's a chain, but, you know, it's fresh fish. We always order the pot, the fish pots, which always have the shrimp and the crab and the clams and the sausage, and it's a really nice presentation, and it's always filling, and it's delicious. These people couldn't even get hush puppies together.
Yeah, and if you don't know, the recipe for hush puppies is effectively cornmeal, water, a little bit of pepper, and you deep fry that.
Right.
It doesn't take a genius.
Right. You take an ice cream scoop, or if you want them a little smaller, okay, fine, but you scoop it and you drop it in. No, these were awful. They were obviously frozen and just heated in a microwave oven. And what made it worse was when they brought it with butter, it was like warmed up butter. It's like, you don't do that. You serve it with regular butter.
Right.
I mean, they got everything wrong, and I'm just quietly biding my time and waiting and hoping for them to go out of business.
I
told you so.
Yeah, and it won't be long, like you said. And I do, after our last couple of shows, want to mention the fact that we will eventually bring this back around to Happy Fun Time, because we do have some things to talk about near the end of today's show that are just absolute joy. However, in between time, we do have a little bit of politics to discuss, and we do have one more thing along the customer service line, because over the last 2 days, I have spent, all told, about an hour and a half in 3 separate phone calls with Sirius XM. And I am ready to go through the roof because their customer service, and it, you know, I want to point something out here, because when it comes to accents, whether it's Spanish, because we had that one a couple of times, Spanish of some Latin American extraction, or, you know, Pakistani, which seems to be more and more common all the time, or Indian or whatever. I don't care, generally speaking. If you can get your shit done, I don't care what you sound like. I'm not one of those guys that goes, how come we can't have customer service here? Because it doesn't make any difference, as long as the customer service is worth a shit. But they have at Sirius XM what I would consider to be one of the worst business practices, and I know why they do it, because it makes them money. But what they do is they sign you up for whatever length of time you sign up for, whatever length of time you're stupid enough to sign up for, whether it's 6 months or a year or even month to month. And they automatically renew you. So what they do is they draw you in with a 6 month, hey, we'll give you the whole 6 months for $40, and it'll give you every channel you want and all the football games and everything. So you sign up for that. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, 6 months later, when you're not thinking about it, you get billed or charged, if you're stupid enough to give them your card number and tell them to go ahead and keep it on file, for like $150. So, because then it renews at the quote unquote regular rate. So we got that email over the weekend, and I said, oh, here we go again. I got to go through this crap. So I called them and I said, okay, we're not doing that. Find another package and get my wife's car back going. And, you know, and because I didn't let them automatically renew it, it didn't charge, but all of a sudden I had this outstanding bill for $127. So they, you know, after going back and forth with them on the phone, and why don't you just, you know, let the service lapse instead of automatically trying to renew it? Oh, we can't do that. Yes, you can. You just don't. And after going around that mulberry bush for a while, finally they said, okay, here's what we'll do. We'll give you the next 6 months on the Jeep, which is my wife's car, for $30. And I said, okay, fine. And I said, and you'll leave my car alone and it'll continue to renew at $10 a month. And they said, yes, no problem. So I said, all right, fine. And they go through their whole spiel at the end of the call. And they said, is this all okay with you? And I said, yes, it is. And we left. And, you know, again, that took about an hour and a half and 2 different phone calls. So then my wife called me today, less than 24 hours later, in a panic, because she had gotten an email from Sirius saying, you haven't paid your bill and you owe us $110. Now, they had already charged me the $30 for the next 6 months. That came out of the account this morning, so that's already gone. So on top of whatever they, you know, they told me yesterday, they said that somehow we owed them $110. So I was back on the phone going, all right, here's what's going to happen now. You're going to fix this, or I'm going to reach through this phone line, grab you by the neck, and pull you all the way to St. Louis. So, you know, again, round the mulberry bush and another 45 minutes out of my life. And finally, they got it right, because what they had done is, instead of putting the 6 month package on her car, they put it on mine for some inexplicable reason, and then left hers alone. And then decided to charge her $110 for the automatic renewal fee, which is what I had called to cancel in the first place.
And you made it very clear how it was supposed to go.
Oh, yeah.
$3 on her car, $10 on yours. That's not a difficult nor lofty concept to try and understand, unless you're trying to run a scam, of course.
Right. Exactly. Which I am more and more convinced as the days go on that that's exactly what they're doing. But yeah, we finally got it done, I think. But then again, who knows what email we're going to get tomorrow?
Well, here's the thing. I haven't dealt with, quote, Sirius XM since it was just XM. you know, I've had it since 2005.
Yeah.
And I've never dealt with them in the time since they merged. But I really believe that once the Sirius end of it came in, they destroyed everything that was good about XM because their customer service was excellent.
Yeah, not anymore.
It really was. You know, I shudder to think. I mean, we just have the Sirius XM actual radio that, you know, it renews in December and that's it. You know, we have the one radio. It's one of those. I mean, it's it's only the second radio I've ever had because I had the old Rode 2, and this one's the Rode XT, and I've had the Rode XT for about 12 years now in there.
The only, yes, the, I mean, as far as music is concerned, I have Amazon Unlimited, so I don't care. I can tell my phone to start playing whatever I want to hear, and I'm covered. The only reason I really have Sirius anymore is so that at a moment's notice, if something goes, you know, to hell in a handbasket, I can listen to CNN or the BBC or MSNBC or whatever. Thing is, though, I have a package, I have a TV package on my phone now, too, and what I'm considering doing is getting rid of the XM radio and just having the radio, or having the phone play CNN off of the video through the stereo system in the car. It's the same feed.
If you can pop it in, great. I mean, the thing is, that's what we do, you know, when we go into the car, I take the, because we actually have, and let me backtrack a little bit. In the old days of XM, they used to send out these wonderful promotion packages. And in my case, because I'd gotten onto the whole thing early, they had a thing for an actual boombox where you could have this in your house, you know, an XM, you know, really nice speakers, Delphi.
I remember those, yeah.
You know, it had the changeable bottom so it could fit whichever player you had. And you just pop it in and you can listen at home or you could put it in the car, which is where we would always listen. So the radio itself is here in the house. And then whenever we go out, pop it into the car.
Right.
It's easy as pie. And that boombox didn't cost me a cent because I'd gotten onto the promotion in enough time that I was able to get it for free.
Well,
you know?
You can thank my mom for that, by the way.
Why, did she work for Delphi?
She was the chief financial officer for the company that preceded XM, a company called CD Radio, and they eventually merged into XM.
Excellent. So, which was an excellent I mean, when they started, I mean, Jesus, they had people like Pat D'Anizio, rest his soul, as one of their first on-air personalities doing rock and roll, you know, old rock and roll shows.
She goes back far enough that the antenna, and she has one, you know, in Lucite, like a paperweight, was a little disc, and it had a coax, like, you know, cable TV, you know, that was the hookup, and it would go into the back of the radio. She's got one of those, you know, encased in Lucite that was their first edition, and she was there for the first satellite launch.
Wow. Impressive.
Yeah, fun stuff.
Mom's cool.
She is definitely pretty damn cool. But, yeah, so right now, though, like you said, the customer service has just gone to hell, and I don't know who's running the ship, but I think, you know, it may very well be that they're feeling the same pinch that DirecTV and all of the cable systems are feeling from streaming.
It's also the fact that cable TV and DirecTV are all shit too.
Well, right.
Because, you know, every 2 minutes you turn around and, as you know about the whole thing I told you about Spectrum in New York City, you know, going down for hours upon hours, if not the full day,
mm-hmm.
You know, New York City is your biggest market. It's your corporate hub, and you can't figure out how to get it to not go down for extended periods of time.
Yeah.
You know, that's just basic cable. When it comes to something like DirecTV, it happened when years ago, and it happened a couple of weeks ago as well. Years ago, Liz and I went for a couple of days down to Atlantic City, and it was a rainy afternoon, and we were in the hotel room, and all of a sudden the TVs went out and didn't come back up. Why? Because they had DirecTV. The satellites all went down. A couple of weeks ago, we were having lunch at Chili's because Chili's is in trouble, so we like to take advantage of that with the 3 for $10 lunch special.
There you go.
And, you know, they've got like 7 or 8 sports channels up on the screens at the same time. And they all went down and didn't come back up because it was pouring out.
Yeah, cloud cover. Sure.
What the hell are you paying for?
Yeah, right now, nothing. That's what I'm paying for. So, yeah, it's, you know, the whole thing is going from bad to worse. But sooner or later, it won't matter. And probably sooner because everything is going to move to streaming and there won't be any more of any of this. So that said, The other big news of the weekend. Oh, and by the way, we also got to go see Saturday night. We went and saw Bill Maher. We went to the Fox Theater in St. Louis and saw Bill Maher perform. And he did a good solid 2 hours, but the first half hour was dedicated solely to Donald Trump. Although, one curiosity, we were there at, the doors opened at 8, which would have been 9 o'clock Eastern time. Or, I'm sorry, no, the show started at 8, which would have been 9 o'clock Eastern time. The doors opened at 7, 8 Eastern. And right as the doors were opening came the first news blasts to the phones that John McCain was dead. And so for that hour that we were in the theater, you know, just kind of milling around and waiting for the show to start, and, you know, you overhear conversation and things like that, you could hear the conversation move from things like, hey, how's your day? Or what do you think the show's going to be like? To, hey, John McCain's dead. So that was everywhere. By the time he got out on stage, everybody in the theater knew. And I thought, wow, I wonder if he's going to say anything. Now, not in a way of making a joke about it, because it had just happened, but I wonder if he's going to make mention of the fact that here's this guy that he has interviewed, you know, before on Politically Incorrect and on the show that he does on HBO, and, you know, and nothing. He chose for whatever reason not to say a word about it. And I'm not picking on him. I can get why at a comedy show you don't want to start with, hey, guess what? A beloved senator just died. But I thought it was an interesting choice, given the fact that he's so tied to politics in his act, that he didn't at least say, by the way, how about a quick moment of silence or whatever for John McCain?
Interesting. Very interesting. But he did dedicate how much time to Trump?
About the first half hour, 40 minutes.
A little bit more than I would have given, but okay.
And just tore him up. But then again, he's such an easy target. And
I would say it's just wow.
Even today with the McCain thing, I mean, putting the flags at half staff and then raising them again and then putting them down again when people bitch, they're so stupid, and they don't have any compass about what that's going to. Yeah.
He totally, as a human being, lacks moral fiber to begin with.
Right.
So that's almost, I hate to say it, a given. It's not a sense of resignation that, oh, this is the new reality. No, no. We've always known that he has absolutely nothing to offer humanity.
Right.
Because he has none. You know?
Yeah.
He's what Orwell referred to as an unperson, really, when you get down to it. You know, because he's just this empty, bloated vessel. But, you know, I can – and this is why I get so angry with the rest of the world, because it's stupid shit like this that is being done by the, quote, president of the United States concerning, as you said, a beloved senator who has died, who is an American hero. Whatever your political leanings are, let's look at the big picture here. John McCain was a hero.
Yeah.
And that's all there is to it. The rest of the world looks at something that Trump does like this, just because Trump is a spiteful human being, with the flags being raised back up to their normal height rather than remaining at half staff until what's the legality? Is it till the burial, or is there an actual mourning period?
The legality is that it's a day. It's the day of death and a day after for somebody in Congress. But the end of that section says, at his discretion, the president of the United States can temporarily or permanently change any of this. So that's why frequently you'll see, like when Tip O'Neill died, they'll say, okay, 4 days or 5 days or, you know, until the burial or whatever. And when it's somebody of Tip O'Neill's stature or, you know, Ted Kennedy's stature or certainly John McCain's stature, that's the way it traditionally has been done. But in this case, no.
Well, as I said, Trump has no sense of deference to anyone or anything.
Right.
So
you're right.
It's he made no mention of him today during his little press junket, if you will. He sat there with his arms folded like a spoiled child.
Even when asked. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think we said everything that needs to be said about Donald Trump, because we're not telling anybody anything new. Even our spin is no different than anyone else's.
No.
But let's talk for a minute about John McCain, because He was a hero. He was in combat. He was a POW. He was tortured, you know. He came back to the United States, and he had a very lengthy career as a senator. And again, whether or not you agreed with his politics, he was one of the last ones, one of the few, right up until the day he died, that always put country first.
Yep. Yeah, John McCain was always the guy that you could, first of all, you could disagree with him because he was okay with that. And, you know, as long as you were okay with it as well, you could still walk away still disagreeing with each other, and yet it was fine. And you never got the idea that if you disagreed with him, it was because he hadn't thought it through. Because you knew he had. He cared enough that he thought everything through. And, you know, we may come to different conclusions, but it was never for lack of trying to get there. And the thing that occurred to me, I guess, the most about him, because I would say that the numbers are probably 75-25 in terms of me disagreeing with him versus agreeing with him. But I never held it against him, because with John McCain, you always felt like he thought that whatever he was doing was the right thing for the country. He right. felt it, and he believed it. And it wasn't just, oh, you know, I'm going to change this because of what the party says. You know, that whole idea of being a maverick, every single one of them should be mavericks. Every single one of them should do what they do because it's best for their country and their state or their district or whatever, and they don't. So good for him for that. But you never got the idea that he was just going along to get along.
No. The only real grievance that I ever had with him that I found impardonable was the fact that he brought Sarah Palin to a national stage.
Right. And you got the feeling he really regretted that too.
I've often felt that it really wasn't his idea.
Nope.
It was the machinations of the party.
Right.
Typical.
Yeah, because they said, well, you're not real fun to look at. Let's get somebody who is.
You know, and of course you go back and you read Game Change and you talk to Steve Schmidt or Nicole Wallace and you understand that this was all, they were only following orders.
Right. And there is something that I hesitate to even bring this up, but I'm going to do it for a reason. Because given the fact that, you know, this is not Donald Trump's fault. I want to start there. This is not his fault. He didn't start this. However, because he is who he is and because his followers are as they are, this is starting to make the rounds again online. Because back in 2000, there was a rumor that started going around. And actually, I think it predates that. It may have been his Senate election before that. But there was a rumor that started going around that while he was a prisoner of war, he was feeding information. He was, in effect, a songbird, that he was feeding information to the NVA. Now, that was a campaign pamphlet that nobody ever took any credit for. It was one of those things that somebody printed up in their basement and started putting on windshields in Phoenix, Arizona. So there was never a story behind it. There was, I mean, nobody ever said it. And as soon as they started to do some investigation, all the reporters started calling guys that were in the prison in the Hanoi Hilton with him and said, did you guys ever talk about McCain given? And they said, are you kidding me? No, of course not. So the story was bullshit at the beginning, but it's bullshit that's starting to bubble up to the surface again, because the Trumpies need a reason why he's being such a dick right now about McCain. So I've seen it. I've seen people post it over the last couple of days. If you see it, don't take my word for it. Go to Politico, go to Snopes, go to every source you could possibly imagine. Go to his authorized biographies, his unauthorized biographies. They all say the same thing. That story is horseshit. So, like I said, I hesitated to even bring up the fact that it's out there, but I don't want it to spread any farther than it does without at least acknowledging that, yes, it exists, and no, there is not an ounce of truth to it.
Well, and that needed to be said, so you shouldn't even think about hesitating. And plus, this show, we allow that kind of thing. Yes. Because, folks, we are an alternative information service. You know how facts are alternative facts? Well, we're alternative. We tell the truth.
Yeah, imagine that. It's crazy in this day and age.
Now, since you brought up stories that are false, I think we should definitely, we can move away from the, quote, political scene, but let's stay on the social consciousness level, because this is a story that you and I have been following since the very beginnings of it, and we've both made our feelings known about it, but you very astutely said what was going to start happening. You made a prediction. And we touched on it, I believe, last week. Maybe, maybe not. I'm not sure. But it seems that, and it starts with that actress, Asia Argento,
yep,
who's one of the arbiters of the hashtag MeToo movement.
She's also Dario Argento's daughter, if you're a big fan of Suspiria, which I am.
She made these claims about having been sexually harassed and molested and all of these claims, as so many of these other actresses have done. Last week, it was brought forth, and the facts are there. You can check the New York Times, because for those of you who are very left-leaning, I know that is your Bible.
Right, right.
And so don't look at me. I'm not making this stuff up. It's coming from the New York Times. In fact, it was a breaking news piece. It seems that Asia Argento had, in fact, paid hush money for the fact that she had had sex with a 17-year-old man when she was 37 and, in effect, had committed the act of statutory rape.
Yeah, in California, where that's illegal.
Right. So that's hypocritical domino falling number one. On the heels of this story, who should pop up and rear her ugly little head yet again but that cipher Rose McGowan, had the absolute temerity to go to the press and say, be gentle with her. No, you stupid fucking asshole. You people, that's right, I'm saying you people, you started this bullshit movement to destroy other people because you have an axe to grind with men, period, because your careers have floundered completely. You're telling people that we should be gentle with somebody who fucking lied and committed the act that she's accused others of?
Right.
Someone that she's actually paid hush money? Fuck you very much.
Yeah, and the thing is, the accusations against her could be true, and she could still be a rape victim, because Harvey Weinstein's a piece of shit, and he's a very rapey piece of shit. So I don't doubt her story. The thing is, if you're going to put yourself out there as the face of a movement, and you've committed the same crimes that the movement is there to excise from society, there's a problem there, and you probably might want to find somebody else to be your spokesperson. So, the whole thing is just crocked. And the idea, again, that you automatically have to take the word of the person who is making the accusation. Where is that in American law? Where is that in American tradition? Because the one thing they always told us when I was in school was you're innocent until proven guilty, which brings nicely to Kesha.
Right. We'll stop right there, because right now that's gone out the window, and that's all on the hands of the far left. Whether it's, Antifa or Me Too or any of these bullshit left-wing movements that are spearheaded by the so-called democratic socialists, i.e. the communists.
Uh-huh.
So let us keep this in perspective. You and I are of a different generation, a different educational mindset that was absolutely far more open-minded and all-embracing. So that way we learn in a big picture environment.
Yeah.
You don't have that now. It is very selective teaching. Because just remember, everything is the fault of the Jews.
Yeah. Well, we had to find something to do.
Exactly. So, let's talk about Kesha, because in the last 3 hours, again, this is something that's kind of breaking news. I received a press release from the fellow who was her producer.
Dr. Luke, yeah.
Yeah. Now, if you don't know the story, the short version is, Kesha, the singer, accused Dr. Luke, who is her producer, mentor, co-writer, etc., in the studio, of rape. Outright. Drugging her, getting her drunk, and raping her. These are serious accusations. About as grave as you can get. After many, many, many months of back and forth and testimony and all this, it was discovered that it was all a ruse that she had concocted so she could get out of her contract. which is exactly what people had been saying previously.
Right. And this guy, Ken Levitan, that she was emailing back and forth with, those emails are now public. And and she says things in them like, get me in the mix, I will ruin him.
You know, she made these accusations that he'd also raped Katy Perry. I mean, it's just this horrific litany of all falsehoods.
Yeah. Right.
So you have to stop and ask yourself, where is the reliability? And what happens now? Do these people, in fact, justifiably get taken to task, and for filing false reports, do they finally get their comeuppance too?
Which they should.
That's a crime.
That is a crime. And the only time that you can believe every accuser, is if you live in a world where nobody's crazy and nobody ever has anything to gain. And we're never going to live in that world. So you can't have a position where you always believe the accuser, because there are some people who are self-serving enough that they don't give a shit about ruining your movement.
And more importantly, who doesn't give a shit about anybody else's life when you're that self-serving and it's all about you.
Right. So, yeah, be very, very careful when you start treading around the idea of always believing the accuser. It just never really that kind of led to. Remember that Arthur Miller story? What was it called? The Crucible? Yeah.
Yep.
That's what happens when you always believe the accusers.
Since we're still speaking about music, and now that we're in the music vein of things, let's talk about a couple of things. Let's talk about the negative, and then we're going to go into the positives. Let's talk about, and I say this without trying to retch in the process, the MTV Video Awards, because everybody loves those. Actually, no, nobody gives a flying fuck about any of those, but it seems that Madonna, of all people, was brought out to do the tribute to Aretha Franklin at last week's awards. She came out looking like some kind of retarded version of Boy George's grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
Because God knows, she looked like an asshole.
Oh, yeah.
And her tribute consisted solely of Aretha Franklin, how it pertained to Madonna, because it's all about Madonna. All I can say is this. Shut the fuck up and don't show your face again. Stay in England, you dumb fucking sow.
Yeah, and drop that stupid, phony accent. Oh, my God.
You know, take your Kabbalah, stick it up your ass, go back to fucking England. You haven't been relevant since you put out Ray of Light? It was the last really great album that she did in 97 when she tried dance music.
I'll take your word for it.
Who gives a shit? Madonna, you're old, you're 60. You don't even look hot. I wouldn't want to fuck you anymore. End of story. Go away, bitch. How's that? Now, I want to point out something, because we were talking about the feel-good elements of our show, which, you know, we love the fact, and I'm very, very grateful for the reactions we've gotten over the last two shows, because they've been positive and upbeat. And in the last particular episode, I consciously decided, and I wanted to see if anybody picked up on it, and a few people did, that I didn't use one cuss word. That's over with. I wanted to see it. It was an experiment. Fuck that. Madonna is a parasite. It's back to business as usual here, folks.
Yeah.
But we're here to entertain you and inform you and fill you in and let you see things as they really are.
And did we ever get around to the fact that, and I know we had this lined out for the last episode, and I can't remember if we did it or not, talk about the fact that the Eagles are now number one all time?
No, that's what I wanted to bring up next. And that's where we spin this into the happy side of things. Because there were so many obnoxious and tedious reactions to, oh, I'm with the dude, man. I fucking hate the Eagles. You know what? If you're going to quote a fictional character, put a gun in your mouth and blow your fucking brains out, because you have no use to current society. I mean, most people aren't of any use to society. But as it turns out, as we well know, documented as fact, the original Eagles' greatest hits, 1972 to 1975, was the biggest selling album of the 20th century. It is now officially the biggest selling album of all time. It has, in fact, surpassed Michael Jackson's Thriller. And I could not be happier. Now, you want to sit around and pretend that you're cooler than cool and holier than holy and just a doyen of all things? You listen to that album, you understand why the Eagles were as successful as they were. And that does not include the songs from what would be coming out next, Hotel California.
Right.
These are just the singles from Take It Easy all the way through to One of These Nights. I've been searching for the daughter of the devil himself. I've been searching for
know, I heard people over the course of the last week whining about the fact that it's a best of, it's not even a real album. How come a best of can count? Well, A, because it's an album, and B, this isn't an award. You know, it's not something that anybody is saying, okay, it's deserving of some kind of accolade. It's not being given a Grammy. It's simply a sales figure, for crying out loud. It was an album that existed and it sold a bunch of copies. Who cares? You know, when it comes down to things like, oh, it doesn't count as a real album because it's a best of, get over it.
That's a very well phrased line there, John, from the Eagles album.
Yeah, right. I didn't even mean to do that.
What was it?
Hell Freezes Over.
Yeah, I think you're right. But yeah, so I'm very happy to see that the Eagles now have the biggest selling record of all time, deservedly so, because they are a band of a generation. The way the Beatles were the band of the 60s, I'm sorry, but the Eagles were the band of the 70s.
No doubt.
They were. You know, you love them or hate them, and that's all there is to it. And I, in my older, wizened years, have regained a great appreciation for just how good those guys were as musicians, players, singers, writers. You know, these guys wrote those songs. It wasn't like they had something just handed to them and were told, go sing. No, those guys were a real band. So
right.
All the credit in the world to them, and congratulations to them, well deserved. Now, another couple of musical notes. Ha ha! One, I happen to fortunately stumble upon, as much as I dislike James Corden, an hour-long carpool karaoke of him and Paul McCartney in Liverpool. God loves Paul McCartney. He is just a wonderful person. He's so entertaining, such a joy to watch.
Was that fantastic?
It was. I have to admit, I got alternately chills and tears. It was just wonderful to see how he's so unpretentious to this. He's the biggest star in the world. I'm sorry. There's nobody bigger than Paul McCartney. There just isn't.
Right.
Okay? And he's been the biggest star in the world since that band came over here 54 years ago?
Uh-huh.
The fact that he is so great with the fans, he's so in tune with the fans, and he's having fun, even now. It was just a moment of pure, unadulterated joy to watch.
The concert footage that they did at the little bar, that was great. And to see those guitars that came out on stage, his and the rest of the band pulling out these amazing, amazing pieces of equipment. There was a Gibson ES-335 12 string that came out. There was a Dan Electro. I was very happy to see an old Dan Electro U2 come out on stage. That was so much fun to watch. But I want to tell you something. That the piece where they went to his house that he lived in as a teenager.
Yeah.
And the woman who lived there, and she got to stay there through the whole thing, watching it all go down, you know, and yeah, there's a camera crew in there as well. But you know, the fact that they did that, and the current owner of that little apartment in Liverpool was able to be a part of that. And you could see it on her face, and there's still hanging on the walls, pictures of nothing but Paul McCartney and his dad and all this other stuff.
Going to the barbershop on Penny Lane, you know?
Yeah.
The look on the people's faces, or when he pops up from behind at the statue of the Beatles.
Right.
And all these people are tweeting, oh my God, Paul McCartney is here.
Yeah.
You know? Or when he goes and signs the Abbey Road sign, he's like, no one's going to believe this anyway. So, I mean, he's such a treasure. He is a joy, and this is why the man is my all-time hero.
Yeah.
So glad to see that. It was just so much fun. And like I said, I'm not a fan of James Corden, but hey, you know what? That was just something really, really special. Now, let's talk about a couple of other musical bits. The Chris Bell book is officially out, right? It came out last week. But news along those – and I'm bringing this up for a reason, because this does pertain to – something peripheral about Big Star. So the book came out, and at the same time as the book coming out, and it's a wonderful book by Rich Tupica, There Was a Light. You know about this. We've talked about it.
Yep.
It's available now. Get it on Amazon or buy it directly from Hozak Records and Books. The same time that the book officially came out, an announcement came out from a band that we all love, Teenage Fan Club, that co-founder Jerry Love was leaving the band after 30 years. Right now, The reason I bring this up is, as we all know, Teenage Fan Club, like the Posies, are looked upon as the offspring of big stars.
Uh-huh.
And I have been many, many times over the last two decades jokingly referred to as Teenage Fan Club's bandwagon-esque album as Big Star's fourth. Ken Stringfellow of the Posies / Big Star cryptically posted on his Facebook feed, because the announcement of Jerry Love's departure started spreading rumors like wildfire that, in fact, Teenage Fan Club were finally calling it a day.
Uh-huh.
But in the words of Ken, quote-unquote, "So as unfortunate as Jerry Love's departure from Teenage Fan Club is, it does open the door to merging Big Star and Teenage Fan Club one degree closer, hint, hint, hint. So could that conceivably, and I know I'm spitballing here, could that conceivably mean that Norman Blake, guitarist and singer of Teenage Fan Club, would join John Auer, Ken Stringfellow, and Jody Stevens is a reconstituted version of Big Star? Is that a possible hint?
Wow.
Or is it just fucking with us? I don't know. But I'll tell you something. I would pay to see that, because it really would be the perfect melding, you know? Yeah. I mean, to me, an ideal reconstituted Big Star, of course, would have had Stamey, Holzapfel, you know, Chilton, and Jody, you know? That never came to fruition. But since I brought up Peter Holzapfel, let's talk about the new album from Mr. H, The Ever-Loving Game Day, which I have had a chance to listen to and absorb, and your copy is on your way to you.
Excellent. Thank you.
It's reviewed now. The review is up on musictap.net. I want to try and not sound like a fanboy, because it's just impossible not to. You know, I love Peter Holzapfel's work. He's been such a tremendous influence on me since I first heard Bad Reputation in 1981. I mean, but notwithstanding, this album is an amazing piece of work. A, by the fact that he played 99% of all the instruments himself.
Yeah.
Save for the horns and strings on a couple of the tracks that it appears on, obviously. But the quality of his musicianship is at an all-time high. He's still, for someone who likes to downplay his talent and skills, his ability to write memorable hooks and play a fiery guitar, just absolutely, absolutely beyond words, really. It is a wonderful album. The songs, I mean, they're all... where do I begin without gushing too much? You know, I don't want to go overboard, because I don't want to, you know, I want people to hear this album and take it as a whole. You know, I don't want to, you know, parse the songs individually and say, well, this is great and that's great. No. There's 16 songs on here that have to be heard, period. The whole thing. But just to give you a little bit of a sampler and a taster, okay? The opening track, it's almost trademark Holzapfel. It's got that kind of witty, if you know his lyrical style, it's always kind of wry and witty and very tongue-in-cheek, and a lot of it is self-deprecating, and sure enough, it is here. You know, it's got that kind of 60s garage groove to it.
Yeah.
And the lyrics are basically about, you know, literally getting back in the game.
I knew a man for men, and they slept on floors and drove a Chevy van, and they got pretty good and made it all they could, but then the singer slipped and it all went south. To get back in the game, and everything will have changed.
Now skip down to one of the other tracks is The Smartest Thing I've Ever Done, which is, it's kind of like a country fried, you know, upbeat thing, and you think with a title like The Smartest Thing I've Ever Done is probably some love song. No. It's a shot at himself for doing the dumbest thing he thinks he ever did. Because basically the lyric is, it wasn't the smartest thing I've ever done.
Yeah, right. There you go.
Being a man, and it's wonderful. And then there's a track called Don't Ever Leave, where it's just him, his voice, and an organ that when you hear it, you think right away, Rod Argent. This is definitely the Zombies influence, you know? And I'm just going to give you those because I really want you to go and listen to this album. Look it up on YouTube, whatever you need to do. I say buy it. Buy it because it's worth every cent. It's not, there's no bad tracks on here. There's no so-so tracks. It's a wonderful piece of work and a fine return to form. He's out there playing now in a three-piece called the Peter Hulse Apple Combo, which includes Will Rigby from the DBs on drums. Go see him. If you have a chance, by all means, go see him. This is a wonderful, wonderful piece of work, and I'm so glad that he has done this and that it's even better than I thought it was going to be, because I thought it was going to be really great.
Excellent.
And it is. I mean, he's really – and I will say this, and I say this as a fan. Some of the songs, I can immediately hear the DBs. You know, I can hear them putting their parts to it, but either way, it's a win-win because it's Hulse Apple's work. And he just shines completely.
Good deal. All right. Now, and before we get to the In Our Head segment this time around, there is one other quick thing I wanted to make note of. And you can go back and check our last edition if you don't believe what I'm saying right now. But I do love it when something I guess at turns out to be exactly true. Because when you and I were talking about Paul Manafort, the last time we talked, it was a week ago. God. It was a week ago Monday. Mm-hmm. And we were waiting to find out what the verdict was going to be. And there had been some rumblings about worry among the prosecutors and are they going to get a conviction? And of course, we all know now that they got 8 convictions out of 18 counts. And when we didn't know what any of the verdicts were going to be, they thought, oh, wow, if this goes past Tuesday or Wednesday, it's really going to start getting hairy. And what I said at the time was, when they went back and said, okay, give us a very clear definition of what reasonable doubt is, the way I read that is you've got one holdout, maybe two, and they're trying to convince them, okay, we've got this guy, he did all of this stuff, and... You know, there were at least a few counts where they were saying, well, I'm not so sure on these. And it turned out I couldn't have been more right. There was one holdout. And she, it was a woman, was holding out because she said she had reasonable doubt on some of the counts. And the rest of the jury was going, that's not reasonable. 11 people were surrounding her going, what you're saying couldn't be true. And it could, you know, it couldn't have gone that way. Here's the evidence. And she just wasn't having any of it. And she dug in and said, there's no way I'm changing my mind. So they went to the judge and said, okay, is half a loaf all right? And the judge said, sure. So they got their 8 counts and off we go. But yeah, that's everybody was panicking. And I said, no, don't panic. There's one person in there who's being a shit.
Well, here's the other thing about that, because it is exactly as you predicted it was going to be. There was talk about this going over to Mueller. So.
Right.
Therefore, this isn't over yet.
Yeah, also true.
The technical details of it are, but those ten counts or those 10 charges are still very much real, and they're still very much alive and breathing. This is not over yet.
Right. They could just as easily go back and retry with a different jury those other 10 counts. What they're waiting for right now is, do we have to? Because even those counts are all federal charges, which means they're pardonable. And there's another trial coming. You got to remember, regardless of what the prosecutors decide with those 10 charges, he's still facing state charges in New York.
That's it. That was the state charge.
And that part of it, Donald Trump can't pardon because the only thing in his pardoning power is federal charges. So what the prosecutors, I would assume the federal prosecutors in the Southern District are going to do is wait and see what happens at the state level. He's already in prison on the other 8 charges. That's not going to change. So they've got him there. And so all they have to do is wait this out, see what the state does. And if the state comes back with 150 years of prison, then it doesn't matter. Why would you go back and recharge the other 10 charges? Just let him go.
Right. Just let him die in prison. Now, one more thing that we have to bring up. It's happy sad. The last time that we spoke, the Mid-Island League from Staten Island was in one of the semifinal championship games of the Little League World Series. I'm sorry to say that they lost to the Hawaii team. There was a chance for Mid-Island to get into the finals if they had beaten Georgia. After losing to Hawaii, they unfortunately lost to Georgia, so they all went home. happy to say that Hawaii went on and won the Little League World Series.
Yeah, if you're going to lose.
Listen, the kids who beat you won for the third year in a row. They're three-time champions. They beat South Korea. Tip of the hat to the kids from Hawaii. Good job, boys. To my Mid-Island kids, we're very, very proud of you.
Huge and pat on the back to them, big time.
I'll tell you something, and it almost made me cry. The Mets hosted them upon their return from Pennsylvania, hosted them out at Citi Field, joined us for a day at the stadium, run the bases, catch.
That's great.
The whole thing that we dreamt of as kids. And they actually interviewed the coach, you know, and he could not have been classier and more gracious. And all I can say is, you know, job well done this year, just like you did last year. You went further this year, and you're going to go further next year.
That's right.
No puns intended. Wait until next year, boys. It may be yours then.
You got it. And for the In Our Head segment this time around, and again, a huge pat on the back to those kids from Mid-Island. It's funny you should say that sort of happy, sad motif, because that's where we're going to go with In Our Heads this week. And rather than going into the musical world, we're going to go back into the theater, because we lost a giant this week. In fact, just over the last couple of days. And lest you thought that we were going to get through this entire thing without talking about Neil Simon, don't be silly.
At the same time, we also should make a very quick mention. Robin Leach passed away.
Yes.
And so did Ed King, who, if you don't, and that's personal to us, because if you don't know who Ed King was, he was the lead guitarist in the Strawberry Alarm Clock, you know, Incest and Peppermints. And of course, he was first the bass player and then guitarist in Leonard Skinner.
Yeah, right. And, you know, again, an incredibly talented guy. But, you know, when it comes to Neil Simon, long before I even knew that you should pay attention to things like writers and directors and screenwriters and, you know, and playwrights, I was amazed by his work, even if I didn't know who he was. And there were so many movies and so many things that became a part of my life that Neil Simon wrote that, you know, it's impossible to run them all down. But it's funny, because one of the ones that I've seen the most often, and I hate to say this, it doesn't age particularly well, But that has more to do with the way that the movie was produced and the fact that, you know, the fashions of the time look a little weird now. But the story itself is still incredibly funny, and the acting was great. And it was always fun to watch Chevy Chase and Goldie Hawn on screen. It seems like old times. You know, was it Neil Simon's best work? Oh, no, not by far. But was it just a fun piece of work? Absolutely. And it's one of those remote stoppers for me. If I'm flipping channels and Seems Like Old Times is on, I'm stopping and I'm watching the rest of that movie, because it's gonna make me laugh. And by the way, looking at Goldie Hawn at that point in her life, there are a few things you can do in this world that would make you happier.
Well, I mean, that's kind of a given.
So, but, you know, between that and you know, that period of his work, of his plays being made into movies, gave us, you know, this is late 70s, early 80s, gave us what? Seems Like Old Times, Biloxi Blues.
The Goodbye Girl.
The Goodbye Girl, Brighton Beach Memoirs. There was some incredible work
The Tales of Eugene Morris Jerome.
Eugene Jerome. And another thing, Jerome. I mean, just great stuff. And so, like I said, so many of those movies are just intrinsic pieces of my life. And I know that, you know, the same is true for you, because you are who you are and grew up where you did.
Wait a minute. Are you making some kind of intimation, like, because I'm from Brooklyn?
And you're a Jew. Yeah, right.
Heaven's the Murgatroyd.
But yeah, I mean, that stuff, it's like it was custom written for us. And it's funny to everybody. And, you know, it's very approachable humor. But, you know, from the Odd Couple all the way through, you know, I don't think anybody ever wrote better arguments, you know, for the stage or for the screen than Neil Simon did. His arguments are fantastic.
Well, just the bickering between Felix and Oscar in the movie version.
Yep.
That famous scene where Mathau goes, "It took me over an hour and a half to figure out that F you meant Felix Unger."
<You're right. then the scene with the spaghetti where he's throwing the noodles up against the wall. I mean, the whole thing is just, it's golden. So, yeah, I mean, what's the one, I mean, when somebody mentions Neil Simon, what's the picture that you get in your head? Which movie?
I have to admit, it's probably at this stage of my life, the original version of The Odd Couple, because I got it backwards. You know, I didn't know that there was a movie because I was, you know, I was what, 7 or 8 years old when
Same
it
here.
Was on the air.
Yep.
And in 72, all I remember was the theme, and I remember Tony Randall and Jack Klugman. I didn't know that it was originated by Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau. And so I worked my way backwards. And when I saw the movie version, especially now when I look at New York the way it was in the 60s, you know, I have a very, very warm place in my heart, especially in a millisecond of a scene, but when they're walking by Bohacks.
Yes.
Which is a grocery chain in New York, in the New York, Long Island area when I was a child. I mean, that to me is, it's the embodiment of New York. I still think it's his most flowing writing. It's the dialogue that works the most because it's how old now? You know?
Oh, wow.
And it's
yeah.
A TV series that lasted not one, well, not just the one run with Randall and Klugman, but two offshoot versions, remember?
Right.
There was a black version of it.
Yep.
And then there was the shitty version from a couple of years ago.
Right, yeah, with the kid from Friends,
right.
Matthew Perry.
Matthew Perry and then Tom Lennon from The State / Viva Variety and obviously Officer Dangle.
Right.
Chief Dangle from, you know, was it Reno 911? So to me, The Odd Couple is... It's not just his finest, but again, I say it as it's his most memorably flowing dialogue. Look, I'm not going to lie to you. It may sound a little fruity, but I kind of found The Goodbye Girl charming, which is why I thought of it first. You know,
yeah
obviously he wrote it for Marcia Mason because they were married at the time, but it was really Dreyfuss who came off as very, very, he was a sympathetic character, which he wasn't often in most movies. He was an annoying prick.
There's also, yeah, you're right. And I mean, not only was it a great movie and a great TV series, and I found it the same way you did. I mean, that was on TV when I was a little kid, and I found out later, oh my God, there's this incredible movie. Oh. But yeah, that was, in my mind, one of the best adaptations of a movie into a TV series that there ever was.
Well, they picked the two perfect actors to carry on.
Yes.
You know? Tony Randall was just magnificent as Felix Unger because I think he was the way that Felix Unger is portrayed overall is as a priss. And Jack Lemmon wasn't enough of a priss. He was a milquetoast, but he wasn't a wet noodle.
Right.
And Tony Randall was a master of that.
Yep.
He also had that natural drop dead straight faced comedic timing.
Right.
You know? Because Klugman, you knew, was going to come off like, rah, 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 rah. You know, you could just see it, you know? That's what made the series work. So how long did it run? Like 6 years, 7 years?
Yeah, it had to be, at least.
Like from 72 to 78 or something like that?
Yep.
But the fact that it was born of this one golden moment in a movie, where again, it's almost the same flow. You really, if you think about it, the movie goes seamlessly right into the series. And there aren't that many of those types of transitions that you can equate of having the same quality and strength.
Right. But you always knew, and that was the thing about Neil Simon, even with the sort of, you know, lesser works like The Lonely Guy starring Steve Martin in 1984, you always knew if I see his name at the beginning of a movie, if I see Neil Simon, I'm going to feel good when the credits roll. You know what? This movie is going to make me feel good. And it did. And you know, that one piece of The Lonely Guy where he's all depressed and he's a greeting card writer. And his boss comes over and says, let me see what you're working on. And he says, will you be my Valentine? Think about it a bit. If you will, that's great. If not, who gives a shit? I mean, it's just fantastic.
I look at it like this too. He was what, 91?
91 years old. Yeah.
91. This is not a life to be mourned, a passing to be mourned. This is a life to be celebrated.
Definitely.
That body of work is here with us for all time.
Yeah.
It's just that simple. You know?
You know what? I'm inspired by this, and thank you for the responses that you gave, because as always, they're perfectly on point. But inspired by this, I'm going to go find a Neil Simon movie I haven't seen yet, and I'm going to pop it in and just enjoy life for a while.
Well, you know what? It makes me want to actually rewatch The Goodbye Girl. It's just that if I hear David Gates one more time, I'm going to blow my fucking brains out.
And we will leave it at that, Rob Ross. What a great way to put the wraps on this one. Thank you so much, and we'll get together and do it again next week. What do you say?
Absolutely. I hope that those of you who are listening will enjoy this one as much as the last two shows, because God knows this has been a real tour de force, but at least it'll leave you something to be entertained with. And for that, we thank you, and we will see you all again next week.